Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. I'm delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Daniel Hislop. He is research manager at the Institute for Economics and Peace, where he coordinates research and manages IEP's research team. Daniel Hislop, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. Good to talk to you.
It's good to talk to you. I've long known about and made use of and admired the work that your organization does. In the part of the world where I live, we hear the words economics and military together a lot more than economics and peace. Where am I reaching you right now?
We're in sunny Sydney, Australia, so it's early in the morning here.
And what in the world does economics have to do with peace?
Well, I guess the point that we're trying to make is that there need not be an inconsistency between economic prosperity and peacefulness. And one thing that we're really trying to do is highlight the fact that there can be really quite extraordinary economic gains from acquiring a more peaceful society. And that doesn't mean just the end of war, but it actually means a more peaceful society in terms of a better governed society, a more equal society, a society with less corruption and more acceptance of the rights of others and better relations with neighbors.
And I should give the website economicsandpeace.org. What does the Institute for Economics and Peace do? It proliferates this message?
That's right. So I guess our main goal is to try and strip peace of its utopian connotations and to really try and make it a more tangible and measurable metric. Our point of view is to try and measure it yearly, track it, and to see whether or not societies and nations are becoming more or less peaceful, because ultimately if we don't know whether or not we're becoming more peaceful, then how can our interventions actually create a more peaceful world? So the main way we do that is through our Global Peace Index, which is a globally released research project due once a year. That measures 162 countries in the world, or 99% of the world's population, and tracks the peacefulness of those countries.
And you say that peace can be economically beneficial. Does that mean that sometimes war can be, that it depends on the details, or is peace always economically advantageous?
It's pretty much always economically advantageous. In some societies and some circumstances, a war may result in some becoming, I guess, more wealthy. There are obviously some winners that stand to benefit from high levels of conflict. But when you zoom back and look at society as a whole, very rarely, if never, in fact, is war or conflict or violence economically beneficial. And all of our research and a lot of other research done over many, many years proves this.
Are you able to quantify the cost? I saw a paper with a figure over $9 trillion in a year. I think that may have been war and other violence. But what is the cost if you can quantify it?
Yeah, so what we did was to zoom back and look at all the economic expenditures related to conflict, violence, and the consequences of dealing with that violence and preventing it. We call this violence containment expenditure. So essentially, when you add up all those expenditures, and it's things like the big obvious ones, like spending on the military, spending on hospital admissions for assault, spending on police services, judicial services, incarceration, insurance spending to protect against terrorism. You get an enormous amount of money, and that's about $9.46 trillion each year that the global economy spends on containing violence. That's a huge number. Most people can't get their heads around numbers that big, but it's essentially about 11% of the global economy, and that's direct expenditure. That's happening each year. And the majority of that expenditure is fundamentally unproductive. that money was put elsewhere, say into education or healthcare or infrastructure, or even if it was saved by governments and paid back in the form of tax cuts, you would generate a lot more economic productivity, a lot more jobs, and you would also have a more peaceful society.
Are you able to separate out what percentage of that is for war and related violence?
We are. So when you look at the breakdown of the figures, the majority of it, more than 50% of it, is for military spending. And of course, the majority of that is spent by the United States.
More than half of $9 trillion, so more than $4.5 trillion.
Totally. Of global is really related to military expenditure, and we're trying to count not just the direct spending on buying new arms and exports and imports, but also the cost of maintaining armed services, national polices, and this sort of thing. If you just look at the United States' expenditure, that's about $2.6 trillion a year. So the U.S. Accounts for a significant proportion of the global total, in line with the fact that it's also about 22-25% of the global economy.
That's I've seen similar comparisons between the U.S. and the rest of the world, but your numbers are all higher than anything I've ever seen before. When I've seen someone calculate all government spending that goes into militarism, including past payment of debts and interest and care for veterans and so forth, it's been a little over a trillion. How do you get to 2.2 or whatever you said?
So in the case of the United States, the interesting thing is that when people quote Department of Defense spending, they're actually often missing out. I think it's around about $606 billion. That is the number that's often counted.
Sure.
But when you look at federal expenditures, you also have to look at, as you just said, Veterans Affairs, the broader national defense budget, which includes spending on maintaining the nuclear arsenal, Homeland Security spending, which is a really growing area of expenditure in the United States, especially since September 11. And then the debt service on that military spending, as well as the expenditures for Iraq and Afghanistan, which are additional expenditures in the defense budget on top of the $606 billion that often gets counted. You get up to about $1.2 billion. That's about 8.3% of U.S. GDP, on 2010 figures. So
1.2 trillion with a T?
With a T.
Okay.
That's right. And those are direct expenditures. You may have heard larger expenditures quoted from economists like Joseph Stiglitz, who released a book called The $3 Trillion War, which was looking at the cost of Iraq. That was based on a methodology of projecting the cost forward. What we're doing, or what I'm talking about here, is the direct cost in the current year. We do that because we want to illustrate the fact that that money could be diverted into other more productive expenditures in the current year, to show that these things are really about priorities.
But you're still missing $1 trillion to get from 1.2 up to 2.2.
Oh, so in terms of the broader, the total U.S. violence containment expenditure, you then have to count the police, justice, legal, corrections, the growing local government expenditure. That gets you up to about 1.5 of public expenditure, and then you need to look at the private costs. So those private costs include all the private security spending. There's a lot of private security guards employed in, say, the United States now. There's a massive market for locks, car alarms, safes, biometrics, the cybersecurity market. When you look at those costs and those private expenditure costs, you get up to about $600 billion for those. When you add all that together, you're up to about 2.4 trillion US dollars, and that's also including the large insurance industry against terrorism, the medical cost of violent crime, property loss from arson. We're really trying to count all the expenditures that are directly related to violence and containing violence, and imagining, a world where you didn't have these expenditures in place.
It's a very interesting way to look at it that I haven't done before. And, you know, there's some of the things you mentioned I don't find myself dramatically opposed to, such as hospital care for an assault victim I might support, whereas military spending I want to cut. But it's a huge number when you're talking about violence, which we ought to be outgrowing. There's another study from a university in Massachusetts that's quite popular in the United States that suggests that government spending on education and infrastructure and so forth actually produces more jobs than military spending, so that the military spending is not just a huge expense, but it's a huge expense that doesn't benefit the economy. Do you agree with that? Does your own analysis line up with that?
Yes, it does, and I'm familiar with the paper that you're talking about. We actually took that to the next logical conclusion and posit the question of, okay, what if you took the military spending that's in place and diverted that into education, health, infrastructure, and some of those more productive areas that the economists at University of Massachusetts were talking about, and you can significantly reduce unemployment in the U.S. by going through that process. So it's absolutely something that that we make a point about, and it's not to say that military spending, you know, the really key point is not to say that military spending doesn't generate economic activity. Of course it does. You know, Department of Defense is a very large employer. It's the fact that the majority of that money is not as productive when it's spent elsewhere. And to give you some really practical examples, I think, and the numbers, these numbers are quoted quite often. When you look at government spending on civilian purposes, about 70% of the money or the wages that go to an individual are spent domestically. If you compare that to military spending, it's only about 40% of money actually gets spent domestically. So that's one reason why military spending tends to be less productive. But it also includes the fact that a lot of the military hardware that's enormously expensive, and one really big example of this is the Joint Strike Fighter program, which is the most expensive program in U.S. history. Each of those strike fighters, there's only about 1% of their total cost is spent on labor, it's estimated. Very capital-intensive equipment, which can generate technology, but they don't necessarily generate an enormous amount of jobs. So that's sort of one reason why these military expenditures don't tend to not be as productive.
Apart from the fact that most people don't know this yet, what is it that keeps the war machine and the wars coming when all of the other results of war seem to be negative and the economic results sound hugely negative from what you're telling me? What keeps it going?
It's a good question. I think in the U.S., I think the thing that's really important to delineate here is the difference between war and violence. And this is a point that we're really trying to make, and we're trying to make it with our Global Peace Index, which is peace is not just an on-off switch. You're not just peaceful or in a war. It's more to see violence on a continuum, that countries and nations can be, and areas and cities can be either very peaceful, not that peaceful, quite peaceful, or very, very unpeaceful. So that's a really important point. So when we look at the way in which most people, and this is maybe a macabre way of putting it, killed in violence, armed conflict is actually declining. Conflict between states has been declining. This is a long-running trend that U.S. Social scientist Steven Pinker was made in a book recently that was quite prominent. And that point is that while we are getting less interstate conflict between states, we are also seeing quite persistent levels of interpersonal violence and crime and interpersonal homicide. And so it's just a really important point to mention that, yes, war is obviously the state that we definitely want to avoid, but there's also interpersonal violence, domestic violence, just common homicide, which is killing many more people than is. I think the ratio is about 9 to 1. So that's something that we're really trying to make a point of. And when you're looking at, it doesn't really get to answering your question, what keeps war going, but it's going to be a more optimistic point, which is there's hopefully going to be less war, and we're seeing conflict between states decline.
Now, as I'm sure you're familiar, there have been critiques and criticisms of the type of argument in Steven Pinker's book, as well as in his comrade Ian Morris's new book, telling us that war is good for us. And if you look at, for example, the war on Iraq that began in 2003, Steven Pinker seems to treat it as having transformed itself into a civil war the moment George W. Bush declared mission accomplished, so that the bulk of what we think of as a war, he thinks of as a civil war, was a different category, so you don't count it. Then he looks at the number of dead and goes by who was reported in a newspaper rather than any serious study, all of the serious studies having put the dead somewhere between 500,000 and 1.5 million. Then he compares his minimized count of the dead, not with the population of Iraq, of which it was a significant percentage, but with the population of the earth. You know, all of these seem to be modes of coming up with what he wanted for a conclusion, namely that war is going away. Do you see more merit in his calculations than I do?
Look, in terms of some of the detail of the calculations, I have seen some of the critiques, and I can see some validity. These questions were thoroughly reviewed in a study called the Human Security Report, which was released earlier this year. Steven Pinker's approach is to look at the rate relative to the global population, which can give the effect of there being fewer deaths. In terms of my view as to what you should do or what the appropriate approach is, I think his approach is reasonable. But there is, as you say, some legitimate criticism when you look at the fact that just in the last 6 years or last 7 years in the conflict data, an actual increase in not only the number of countries that are experiencing open armed conflict, but a significant increase in the number of deaths. So whilst you've got Syria, you know, with more than 120,000 people being killed, which is a huge event, you've also got several other states with quite devastating open armed conflict. So there is some argument that this longer term trend may not necessarily be something that continues, and certainly when you look at a lot of the fragile states in the world, and this is a point that a lot of people are starting to make, and the rate of population growth in some of these states like Nigeria and Tanzania, where you have many, many poor people, and increasing rates of urbanization, there is the threat of continued conflict and certainly many more people dying of interpersonal conflict. So yeah, that's maybe a bigger discussion, but I think there are some legitimate counter criticisms think his overall thesis.
Well, my biggest concern is hearing from people that we don't need to work to end war because it's ending on its own. As long as we're working to make it end, I'm happy. But I think the Global Peace Index that you referenced is a remarkable tool and really a stunningly, beautifully designed online tool with maps displaying levels of peace of various forms around the world. The website is visionofhumanity.org, which is an interesting name as well. There, I guess my primary question is, why does the United States look so peaceful when I think of it as the largest military in the world with the most troops and the most bases and the most nukes and the most weapons and the most drones and sort of the greatest purveyor of violence on earth, as Martin Luther King Jr. called it? How does it manage to come out sort of in the middle of the rankings?
Yeah. It's funny because normally when we present the results and people see the United States at 99 out of 162 countries, their first impression is, how can the U.S. be so low? Why is it not peaceful?
Yeah, I don't have that question.
Yeah, sure. When you compare, there's no question. Out of the three cross-cutting domains, and there's 22 indicators in the Global Peace Index, there's many different factors at play here, but the three cross-cutting domains of militarization, safety and security, and ongoing domestic international conflicts. Militarization is certainly the area where the U.S. does the worst. And if you rank it on that metric alone, it's certainly in the lower rung, in the bottom group of countries in the world. So if you were just focusing on militarization, then certainly the U.S. would be where you would probably expect it.
But it doesn't really appear that, do you mean the military spending factor in the Global Peace Index?
Yeah, so the militarization aspect of the GPI is measuring not only just the amount of expenditure on the military, but also the number of weapons imports, the number of weapons exports, the heavy weapons capability of the country, whether it has nuclear weapons, whether or not the size of its armed service personnel forces. So it's trying to take account of it. Several different factors, because you can't just measure militarization via one indicator. So it's grouping those indicators together to give you one composite measure, and when you do that in the case of the United States, it certainly is one of the least, or most militarized and therefore least peaceful countries in the world.
Right.
But what you have to bear in mind when you look at the overall rank for the United States is that there's two other domains going on, and we're comparing the United States to all the other countries in the world. So when you look at safety and security, the U.S. has, for a high-income country, relatively high homicide rates. It's obviously got the highest incarceration rate in the world, so it's punished on that score. But when you look at levels of violent crime, perceptions of criminality, the political stability, several of these other internal measures, it's not that peaceful for a high-income country, or certainly compared to some of the Western European countries, but it's much more peaceful than, say, several of the Latin American states, sub-Saharan African states, South Asian states, in terms of its internal security. So that's something that sort of counters the U.S.'s overall score.
Well, that certainly makes sense, and I don't mean to be solely attacking my own country, but it looks like it comes out much better than it deserves. It doesn't sit at the top even in number of conflicts. You seem to have picked three, and I don't know which three. And it doesn't sit at the top in military spending, even though. In terms of number of dollars, it's far and away outspending anybody else.
Yes. So in terms of the military expenditure indicator, it has a proportion of the country's GDP. So the U.S.'s expenditure, whilst far outweighing the rest of the world relative to its, I guess, economic size is not that significant. So when you look at some of the other countries on that particular score, you have some nations that are spending much higher proportions of their GDP on the military. Countries like Zimbabwe, or, you know, the really terrible case of North Korea, even Saudi Arabia, which is spending quite a significant amount of its GDP on the military. So that's one of the tricks, is to try and make these figures relative. As to ongoing conflict, the U.S. calls it three because it has two, it's classified as being in two conflicts, and those two conflicts, and the way this indicator is measured is by looking at the previous 5 years, and regardless of whether or not those conflicts are finished. And in the case of the U.S., it's clearly Iraq and Afghanistan are the two conflicts that it's engaged in, and hence it getting a score of three, which is quite a low score. Most countries in the world are on a one or a two. They're not involved in any other conflicts. That's one measure that actually sort of punishes the U.S. When you zoom back and see the rest of the world.
Well, for sure. But then there are the drone strikes going on in Pakistan and Yemen and the CIA in Syria and Ukraine and the special forces in several dozen countries. And it's just endless. But it's an incredibly useful tool and a remarkable job of presenting it. And I encourage people to go to visionofhumanity.org. Where else should people go? What should they learn? And how can we make our little part of the world and the world as a whole more peaceful? What should we be doing?
Thank you, David. I would encourage people to visit our website, to look at our research materials, to learn more about the way in which we try and measure peace. To try and use the tool as an advocacy tool. So lots of these things, whichever part of the world you're in, and lots of the indicators are directly related to policy. And so if policymakers can help their nation lower their rates of militarization or improve their safety and security, then they can go up in the index. So it's very much about an advocacy effort and to draw people's attention to the idea of peace, and that you can actually, it's not this utopian ideal, and that you actually can change it.
Well, I hope some countries are competing to go up in the index. We would all be better off. We've been speaking with Daniel Hislop. He is research manager at the Institute for Economics and Peace, IEP, and the website is economicsandpeace.org. Daniel, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks so much, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.